off today's show, we are going to be talking about an event happening this week that celebrates the intersection of Detroit's punk, fashion, art, and design. Detroit Underground 69 is more than a month-long exhibit honoring the city's first wave punk scene and its huge aesthetic influence, which can still be seen today far outside its origins as this DIY, raw, and rough-looking youth-driven culture of the 1970s. The event is called the Punk Fashion Symposium, and it happens this Wednesday night at the Metropolitan Museum of Design Detroit. And joining me live in studio are Leslie Ann Peiling, founder and president of the museum, and Rob St. Mary, Detroit journalist, author, and historian on the city's punk and alternative media. Welcome you both to Culture Shift.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Amanda.
Okay, Leslie, you are the founder of the Metropolitan Museum of Design Detroit. So tell me how and why you and your team decided to focus on the city's punk legacy for this year's Detroit Month of Design.
Well, number one, it's a story I lived, and it needed to be told. And so we put it together. We outreached to what we call the advisors, so gathered people who were there besides myself. They happened to be a lot of good friends. And so it was kind of easy in a way. So, we just went for it.
Rob, I want to get you in on this, too, because you've done a ton of great work gathering and documenting the really rich history of alternative culture, especially punk and underground media. Mm-hmm. You released the really incredible Orbit magazine anthology a few years back. So tell me, what makes Detroit's punk DIY art and music scene different from other places? What makes it uniquely Detroit?
Well, I think the thing that's really interesting when we talk about punk in Detroit is that some people will want to go back and say, well, you know, punk started with the Stooges and the MC5. They didn't consider themselves punk. And then there are those that'll say, well, you know, there's Negative Approach and the Necros and all of that around the Freezer scene here in the corridor, which, you know, is hugely important as well. That's its own separate thing. So what I'm sort of have been focused on is what I call the first wave, which would be the people who actually applied the term punk to themselves. And those were the people like Jerry Vile and the Boners, who Jerry, of course, did Orbit magazine, which I grew up reading in the 90s. I was part of the Gold Dollar scene. And then Jerry now still does the Dirty Show. So it's people like him who started White Noise magazine, which was a scene magazine here in Detroit. And the thing that I think is really interesting about that first wave of Detroit punk here is that although people will go, okay, the Ramones was 75 in New York, and then you have the Clash and the Sex Pistols and the Damned over in London, and that comes back. Detroit got going around 77 with Cinecide, with Gutless Radio being considered like the first punk rock single out of Detroit. To, like I say, bands that attach that term to themselves, punk. And so you have that start to develop. And what's really interesting about the scene here is that there were people, you know, sonically, who were part of that earlier scene. So you have Destroy All Monsters, which includes the Ashton brothers who were in the Stooges and Michael Davis from the MC5. So you have this crossover between the earlier era and then this new era that comes in. And I think one of the things that's also really interesting to me when I went back to look at kind of the design elements, I talked to someone like Paul Zimmerman, who created White Noise and went on to work with Fun and Orbit, and Paul's had a great legacy himself as an artist, a designer, and a magazine editor, is that in a lot of way, collages in there, comic books are in there. I don't think we can underestimate the amount of, like, just saturation culturally that those kids had in that era, because they were the TV generation. So they were the ones who were constantly being hit with images all the time. And so I think in some way you can kind of see a corollary to today with, like, meme culture, in that the internet is so in our face in the way that television was so in the face of people in that era, and how that kind of came out. I was also thinking as well, I went to see the new David Bowie documentary over the weekend, and there's a line in there where he was talking about Ziggy Stardust and sort of his thing. And that scene really also had a big impact on people in that scene. And one of the lines that Bowie had about his design ideas for Ziggy and all of that was, and I wrote this down, as he goes, "Everything is rubbish and all rubbish is wonderful." So the idea that it's this throwaway aesthetic, that it's things that people don't want. They know it's dumb. They know it's low culture. And to use those things in a way for commentary or just to get people's attention or to, you know, because the big record labels weren't coming into Detroit. Mm-hmm. The money wasn't there. They had to do it on their own. Mm-hmm. So it was that DIY culture that was really important.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think the DIY in general, the whole you know, aspect of it has always been really big here in Detroit. Detroit's mm-hmm. always been mm-hmm. a do-it-yourself city.
Absolutely.
Right.
You know, and when we talk about punk rock or punk fashion or that aesthetic, you know, New York and London are always the cities that, you know, everyone really immediately thinks of. But, you know, here in Detroit, we have the Stooges, who are incredibly mm-hmm. influential on both of those cities and all of those scenes. So I really think it's interesting how a lot of people maybe outside or outside of Detroit really do know its history mm-hmm. like that. But a lot of times people maybe here don't.
Well, I always use the Werner Herzog quote, the German filmmaker, where he said, well, how come your movies don't do well in Germany? And he says, well, Germans hate their own poets. And one of the things that I used to say when I worked in this newsroom was that, sadly, we don't appreciate our own culture in Detroit a mm-hmm. lot of times. We wait for someone with a funny accent to tell us it has value. And we've seen this over and over again with the Stooges, with the White Stripes, with a lot of different things where it's someone overseas or it's someone in another place who says your culture has value. And sadly, I think we have a tendency in the time to overlook it, because another great Detroiter, Don Was, who's said this quote to me, and I've heard it many times, he goes, when you're all attached to one industry, meaning the auto industry, there's no stratification. You can't show up in a limo. People won't take you serious. There's no way to do that. So he was basically saying it is that blue-collar aesthetic, which I believe is huge into that DIY piece, that a willingness to put your hands in it, to put your hands on it, to do the work. And that's great. But the thing is it doesn't lend to sometimes as a place where people feel that they get the recognition that's due. It's usually from outside that the recognition seems to come in.
I think it's really funny how punk aesthetic, strangely colored hair, ripped clothes, safety pins, all that.
The safety pin in particular.
It's so part of our culture at this point that, you know, no one's getting made fun of if they're doing that.
No.
You see pop stars who take on that aesthetic for, you know, an album or a tour or something. But back then, Leslie, you were there. You were in that scene, and it was rough.
It was rough. You know, we had safety pins because we had to keep our clothes together. We, you know, went basically dumpster diving, you know, just like grabbing whatever we could, you know, wear, put it on. But literally, there's actually a little story. Eric Beeman, who's a well-known jewelry designer here in Detroit, and my friend Kay, S.K. Young, also tells the same story. As he showed up to a party, literally his clothes were pinned together like squares here and there. And the pins just started undoing and coming off, and whatever happened. We didn't have a lot of money, so we just grabbed what we could, and we had a great look, though. We could, we definitely could, you know.
But that aesthetic really upset the squares.
Why do you think it did, I guess, especially in a place like Detroit that is, it's a blue-collar working town, at least especially then in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think part of it was exposing skin, crisscrossing belts, wearing two things at a time, having studs, having over, you know, rough and ready and, you know, worn-in leather jackets and,
Playing with gender,
androgynous fashions, you know, playing it back and forth that way. The closeness that people had just physically in mm-hmm. a space, how it was designed, and like literally hanging on each other, just not thinking other than, you know, it's the cultural binding it together.
Right.
They were, those family.
There's a
family. It was interesting.
There's a great story that, and I brought him up already, Paul Zimmerman tells, is that he lived out in Northville, and they would drive in to Bookies, which is over at 6 and just west of Woodward there. And he said that they would get dressed at home, and it was like, don't stop the car. Because if you had to stop at a gas station or you had to stop somewhere and you were dressed in a particular way, it was very likely you were going to get someone who would confront you, maybe even be violent to you because of the way you're dressed. And that could be because your hair's different color or you're oddly dressed in some manner. And I don't think we can really kind of get our heads around that today, because if someone has, like, you know, blue hair or is, you know, dressed in a particular manner, there isn't that, I don't think, today.
No, right. I don't think at all. No.
It was definitely in the bathrooms. People were getting redressed. You know, the whole idea, I'm not sure 100%, but the whole idea of lipstick being written on the mirror is because everybody was in the, didn't it actually matter if it was boy, there was no even, like, boys or girls, whatever gender, however you want to say it, were getting redressed together. So people were literally putting their makeup on. Somebody, I think, is organic is starting to write with lipstick on the mirror. Like, now you see it all the time. Also, back seats. Back seats were definitely a place that people got redressed.
Mm-hmm.
And they are right next to the club, so they could just go right in. Because they're not going to get dressed, go to stop at a gas station. Oh, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking a lot about the, you know, the outside world being very aggressive against punk fashion and punk culture at that time. But, you know, Leslie, you were there. What about families, parents?
So I happen to have very liberal parents. Both my parents taught at Wayne State, and they were cultural anthropologists. So let's just say that they didn't really count. But I couldn't go over to my friend's house, pick my friend up necessarily, and then go out. I'd have to later redress, because maybe those parents were a little more conservative and it wasn't necessarily accepting. We never were. Yeah, we were sometimes we'd have a few pieces, you know, underneath our clothing, and then take those conservative outer pieces off and then reveal what we actually were. We were punk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we didn't go around and saying we were punk. We just were.
Yeah, and you don't really see that in any scenes where you have to kind of hide what you look like until you get to the place where you can be with your people. So as you're describing this, I just picture this really deep bonds that were created at that time.
You're so right. And matter of fact, though, the people who were in my circle and Rob's circle they're still talking with each other. They're still part of that family. It didn't go away. And even now, I teach at CCS, fashion design department. And one of my students, you know, we were talking about doing this whole punk thing. And this one of my students, Jacob, said, "Do you know that I'm in a punk band?" And I was like, "What?" It's called the Seamsters. So they also are now it's very, very common at CCS and other schools that also have that family started.
Mm-hmm.
So it's now another, we'll call it time era in a way. But again, and they even say the same thing about they're getting redressed sometimes, not as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We talked a lot about the fashion of the time, or at least that is the point of the event happening this Wednesday.
Yeah,
it is a punk fashion show celebrating that look, but there is a lot more to it, a lot more aesthetic influence that the DIY and first wave punk scene had. Go into a little bit of that. What visually defines it?
So I'm going to talk in particular about Bookies, because that's where I went. I didn't really go to the other clubs. So we have recreated the black and white checkered floor. Even at the museum, at MOD, that's a nickname for Metropolitan Museum of Design Detroit. And the albums or the actual 45s, since they didn't have enough money to actually make a whole album, they made 45s, and the graphic arts on the outside of the covers and the flyers were amazing. And then we have an enormous collection of the flyers that you will also see, so to do with graphic design, etc. So that part. There's also just the equipment, the actual equipment that was, recorded on, that kind of thing. There's a plethora, I love that word, plethora, of pictures taken by S.K. Young and others. So imagine you're in a bar as a black and white checkered floor. It used to be a very fancy dinner club.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's remnants of even the gold gilding a bit on the, on the walls or ceiling, that kind of thing. So we have a little bit of that. But then you also have like these pictures, they're amazing. So there's hundreds of pictures on this one particular piece. The reality is there's a camera on the table. And we actually don't know who actually took all those pictures, because everybody would just grab whatever camera and take pictures. So there's a trust. That word trust and punk, I think, are really blended together.
Mm-hmm. Let's get into some of the music, because this is a band you would have been seeing at that time at playing bookies in the, you know, early 1980s, late 1970s, Cinecide.
Yeah.
Okay, Rump, tell me the history of this band.
Well, Cinecide starts in the early 70s. They're considered one of the first wave originators. They put out the first punk rock single in April of 77 called Gutless Radio, and Gary Reichel and Jim Olensky ran Thomas Video. So if you're a local film nerd, you remember Thomas Video.
So. Oh, yeah, for sure. All right, let's hear it. This is Cinecide, Single Warning. Released in 1982, that is Detroit's Cinecide, Single Warning, the name of that track. And we are talking to Leslie Ann Pilling, the founder and president of the Metropolitan Museum of Design Detroit. Rob St. Mary joining us here. He's a journalist, author, and a historian of the city's punk and alternative scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And so this Wednesday, we're going to talk about the event in a minute, though. But you know, it's so... Not being at that time, you know, but being a punk when I was in high school,
right,
and loving the music, loving the aesthetic and everything. It's still a bit hard for me to wrap my head around about why initially this was so controversial. Why was it so upsetting to the status quo if you had green hair?
Well, I think when I look at it culturally, and Leslie maybe has her own opinion of it because she was actually there. I was born in February of 78 when bands first started to play at bookies. But when I look at that scene compared to scenes that were before them, it really crosses a lot of lines in that it is, you have bands that are multi-ethnic, multi-gender, you have, you know, sexual orientation. So, and you have to remember that by this time in the late 70s, you have the women's rights movement, you've got the queer rights movement, you have all of these, you know, and of course the struggle for civil rights for African Americans and other people of color. So there's all of that that's playing in this scene. And unlike the Grandy scene that was like 10 years before, with rare exception, was, and I don't mean this in a negative way, it was kind of a white boy festival. Like all the bands were working class white guys. And that's great. And I love those bands. But by the time you get to the late 70s, all of this change politically really starts to come together. And in a town like this that is very blue collar, and I hate to say it, we get used to regiment. We get used to clocking in and clocking out and having structure in that way, because that's how the cars were built. This runs counter to that, and it runs up against it. And that is where I think it grated on some people.
Yeah. And Leslie, what do you think it was that was so upsetting to people that they would be wanting to, you know, beat you up at a gas station if you were dressed differently?
Well, I think a lot of it, actually, what Rob said, it is very inclusive. So for what we would now call the queer movement or the population community, what we used to say the gay community, they were very inclusive. The punk scene community and on their own were very, very inclusive. So that ran up against politics, norms, whatever it happened to be, the different, the blue collar community,
right,
thought of. So I think that's where it is. Also, just visually looking at people who dressed, quote unquote, in the punk. They looked a little bit, we'll call it street gang-ish.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, why it was, we'll just bring the word fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's why I was brought in, and that's why this violent, scary time for people who just wanted to express themselves.
And I would be remiss if I did not, you know, mention that Bookies was a gay club. So
yes.
It had been actually the second Cliff Bell's location. It was built in the 40s. And by the time the 70s comes around, it's a gay bar. And then the kids come in and they start booking the shows and pretty much take over the joint. So there was this mix with the queer community that was kind of coalescing right in there in Palmer Park at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So happening this Wednesday, the Detroit Underground 69, it is a more than a month-long exhibit. It wraps up October 22nd of flyers and zines and all of those, the aesthetic things we're talking about with punk rock culture here in Detroit. But this Wednesday, something very special is happening.
It is. It is. So imagine a glorified show and tell. So peep, not a, and being very respectful of the punk community as well. So people are coming, even with their favorite piece, or coming completely dressed how they normally would in their everyday life, and they identify as punk. They might bring extra clothing and have another person with them and also create a styled look for people to just talk to each other and kind of hang out. And we do have these discussions in the round. Rob will also be there, and we'll be talking about fashion, punk, and what was a little bit different on the looks and what do they do now. You know, what do we do now? Because I still identify as punk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
That is happening this Wednesday night at the Metropolitan Museum of Design Detroit, which is in Collected Detroit on 4th Street near the city's Midtown.
Yes.
All right, Leslie Ann Pilling, thank you so much. You are the founder and president of the museum. Rob St. Mary, journalist and author of the Orbit Magazine Anthology and runs the Punk Rock Archive.
Thank you, Amanda.
All right. Thank you, guys. Let's get into another band you would have been hearing at that time. It was re-released, this album re-released by Third Man Records in 2020, and that is the band L7, Flowers of Romance.